In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. When a tropical storm recently moved up from the southern U.S. coast, it dropped a high rate of rainfall per hour over the New York City area. The city's storm drains are not designed for that rate of rainfall, and flash flooding occurred. Images of cars, subway stations, and basement apartments submerged in floodwater gave opportunities for key individuals to connect this type of storm to a climate change agenda. One of those individuals was New York's chief climate officer, Rohit Agrawala. He was mentioned in a newspaper article saying he, quote, stressed that climate change probably contributed to the intensity of the rainfall and that it overwhelmed stormwater systems. And also, quote, the sad reality is our climate is changing faster than our infrastructure can respond. Okay. According to his biography, he is a widely recognized expert on urban sustainability, technology, and mobility. He led the creation of the Mayor's Office of Long-Term Planning and Sustainability under Mayor Bloomberg, and served as president of the Board of Directors of the C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. He was part of the founding team at Sidewalk Labs, Google's urban technology startup, and more recently was a senior urban tech fellow at Jacobs Cornell Technion Institute. This is some of his biography. I want to point out Rosa Corey's warning about Agenda 21 buzzwords. She's the author of the book Behind the Green Mask. It's a must read. The first word she warns about was sustainability. Mobility is another one. Now, she's warning because these are the buzzwords for someone connected into the Agenda 21, or now it's 2030. Corey had pointed out for decades how there are people embedded into positions of leadership in municipalities across the country that answer to non-U.S. government bodies and are involved with making UN Agenda 21 or 2030 changes to public policy and law. So, okay, New York City's climate change expert is a founding team member of Sidewalk Labs, a Google-funded, failed smart city in Toronto's waterfront, built out with 24/7 sensors in nearly everything, cameras, to capture all activity. One primary reason for the failure is the lack of privacy after promising privacy would be intact. Researchers point out that smart cities exist to profit from collected data under the guise of controlling resources for a better environment. The utopian smart city model would be sensors embedded in everything, including the human body. All of that data collected by transmitting and receiving from sensors to an environment saturated with microwaves or millimeter waves. That data is then traded on the stock exchange and ledgered with blockchain. All of this lines up with the proposed digital currency systems. Political candidates know this. RFK Jr. knows this. Remember the work that Professor Charles Lieber was doing at Wuhan University of Technology and the connection to 5G. He was developing human nanosensor implants. He was developing, with other Chinese scientists, human nanosensor implants. But getting back to New York City's climate change expert's bio, he was also on the board of the directors of C40 Cities Climate Leadership Group. These groups propose changes to cities that include meat and dairy dietary restriction, increased surveillance, not unlike what they've tried to do with Sidewalk Labs. It's known governments, military, and private contractors deploy real-time weather control technology, why wouldn't this technology be used to create the appearance of a climate crisis? For most listeners tuning into this type of research and information, the climate change agenda and climate engineering go together. They're not fooling anyone. Many saw the heavy spraying prior to the storm's arrival into the New York City area. As seen by the public response to the disastrous event on the island of Maui, the climate change agenda connects to willful arson and geoengineering, weather control, which connects to the 15-minute smart cities, which connects to 24/7 surveillance and digital slavery. The corporate media will not connect the dots. We go now to hear the voices from a climate engineering documentary. Let's have a listen. Plans to leverage the powerful forces of nature have been on the table in think tanks for years, says physicist Ken Caldera. He's a senior scientist with the Department of Global Ecology at Stanford University.
I used to work at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and I once participated in a meeting where we all sat around the room and thought about how could we manipulate geophysical systems to use it as a weapon. The meeting was about weaponizing geophysical interventions. That means, you know, could you somehow interfere in Earth functioning in a way that you could use it as a military weapon? Could you change climate? What could you do in terms of manipulating the sort of Earth's physical systems to as a weapon? Well, you know, some of the ideas were, okay, we could blow up hydrogen bombs, you know, underwater, offshore, and make a tidal wave that would go over a city. And, you know, the result was, well, isn't it easier just to drop the hydrogen bombs on the city? You know, now you could imagine, though, say, putting pathogens in a cloud, let the cloud, go over somewhere, and then would rain down on your enemy and create, you know, do chemical or term warfare in this kind of way. And that might work against something that would say as big as the former Soviet Union, where, you know, you could be pretty sure that within a few days that cloud would rain out.
Superpower militaries, including the United States, have quietly made advances with the technology to control weather, perfecting ways to exploit the powerful energies of weather for tactical advantages in war. We mostly don't hear about this in the media. It's conducted in secret, without public consent, mostly behind protection of national security laws. You can find examples of these projects in U.S. military white paper studies that list ways to weaponize the Earth's natural forces, such as the U.S. Air Force publication titled "The Weather is a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025. These studies have warfare at their center, using terms such as full-spectrum dominance. One goal of this U.S. military report is strategic control of the weather over battlefields in distant countries in the next 20 years. This ongoing activity includes modifying the weather and atmosphere on local and massive scales for future scenarios of weather warfare, the results of which, many researchers say, may have altered the global weather equilibrium.
It's very tricky. We have an extremely perturbed atmosphere, and we're now attempting to manipulate it with radio electromagnetic beams, the Chemtrails Project, and many other projects.
Award-winning investigative journalist William Thomas began publishing articles on the topic of weather modification in 1999 for the Environmental News Service. Thomas says weather modification and warfare go together, and military superpowers have long been interested in manipulating weather for warfare.
During the Vietnam War, we saw Operation Popeye attempt to wash out the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the main supply line from North Vietnam into South Vietnam, by seeding monsoon clouds. They managed to create quite a bit of rain, but they did not stop the North Vietnamese bringing supplies down on bicycles.
Since the Vietnam War, this technology has radically advanced. Researchers say perfected weather control technology could enable a military to withhold rain, cause floods, drought, storms, and bring any country to its knees without firing a shot. Thomas says, "This is treading on dangerous ground. It's here. We are dealing with the chaos realm, and most likely the butterfly effect.
We just don't know what we're tampering with. What we do know is that as global warming accelerates drastically, we're giving further nudges to a system that is very much destabilized. Very dangerous practice here, trying to control something we don't understand."
Cindy Pakulis, welcome to In Other News.
Thank you.
Now,
nice to be here.
It's good to have you. For full disclosure, we had met recently and we're together on Sunday at an event speaking about Who Owns the Weather was the title of the event. And you really had a fantastic presentation, and I thought that it could really translate well on the air and for listeners to grasp a bigger picture that you presented by connecting many dots. I don't see this being done very often. That's why I thought it'd be a good idea to have you on the show. Can you give listeners a little bit of a background in terms of how you got interested in this?
Well, I became aware of the sky through my husband. He was about a year ago, maybe 10 months ago, he was sitting outside and he noticed a lot of planes in the sky. Within 2 or 3 hours, he noticed that they were making long white trails, that the sun became occluded, and we had a white sky. And he went online and started researching it. And when I came home that day, I'm a school teacher, when I came home from work, he mentioned it to me. And then I started investigating it and was absolutely amazed by what I found. And then the Deepwell Horizon accident happened in the Gulf of Mexico. And I just couldn't understand it. So I started investigating the corporations that were involved in that accident, and that's what led me to so many different areas and so many different corporations that were involved in the aerosol program, what I believe, the accident in the Gulf, and many other things, Monsanto, genetically modified organisms, they're all pretty much, they all have a piece of the pie.
At this point, you look at the Gulf oil disaster with BP. From there, you made even larger connections. And let's start, in your presentation, you started with the patents that go all the way back to 1927. So this is something that was being planned, it seems, for a long time. I guess these nozzles that were being manufactured to atomize chemicals. And tell us about that.
Well, when I first started researching, I was really focusing on the patent that was created in 1975 for powder contrail generation. And then there was another one in 1977 for creating combustible compositions for generating aerosols. And then the more you research and the more you look around, you find out, like you said, 1927, they were looking at a process of producing smoke clouds from moving aircraft. In 1934, they had a patent for airplane spray equipment. In 1951, another one for controlling the weather. And even today, we have something like 66 weather stations for modifying clouds to increase rain, decrease rain, create drought conditions, where someone who is in the government that lives within that city can apply to have their clouds seeded. So all of these patents have gone back for a very long time. And they continue to make patents in regard to this as the equipment gets more advanced. There's one that was created in 1956, again, controllable dispersal device. I guess that improved on the previous one from 1927 and 1934. There are tons and tons. 1969, method and apparatus for seeding clouds. And it gets a little scary when you start to see the patents for aluminum in 1974, chaff dispensing system that the Navy uses to seed the clouds with aluminum. There's one in 1974, rocket having barium release system to create ion clouds in the atmosphere. And I know we touched on HARP at the seminar on Sunday. So, and all of these are the particles that are starting to show up in the studies that people are taking of their water and soil throughout the globe.
We interviewed Mike Murphy last week, and I don't want to belabor this issue too much, but the reason this is really critical to understand is that these large companies that are really dominating at this moment are intricately connected to all of this. And your presentation really shed some light. And I bet on some level you kind of just scratched the surface. And there's so much more work that needs to be done to really pull all this out. I know Goldman Sachs figures prominently in a lot of these connections. And I just recently found that they donated $1 million to Obama's campaign. And they figured prominently in the Gulf oil disaster as well. We're going to visit that a little bit later. But so you've gone through the patents. You've assessed that over decades, the goal is to perfect these mechanisms for dispersal in some ways. But then ARCO plays a very interesting role in all of this. Can you tell listeners about what you found out about this aluminum company?
Well, you know, it's funny because, as you're saying, a lot of it is based on these dispersal systems through airplanes. And there's so many fingers that branch out from this, because then you can start investigating biowarfare, which is, of course, spread through aerosols released from planes. And like you said, ARCO does play prominently in it. And here is another connection. BP bought ARCO, I believe it was in 2000. But ARCO was originally one of the seven sisters that was broken up from Standard Oil in 1911, which was owned by the Rockefellers. And in that breakup, Exxon, Amoco, and a couple of others, Rockefeller maintained a quarter ownership of each of those companies. So when BP purchased ARCO in 2000, he was, in actuality, part of it was being purchased from Rockefeller. So, and ARCO was one of the original contractors for HARP, and that's also a connection because HARP, as we discussed, is their purpose is to, you know, change the ionosphere and make it more of a plasma, and you do that through inserting barium and aluminum into the atmosphere. And ARCO also has its own company, which is one of the biggest aluminum-producing companies in the world, and when BP bought that, they also got that. So I guess it was an added. And BP on its own right is one of the biggest chemical companies in the world.
They're all related. HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, if some listeners don't know, it's the High Frequency Active Aurora Research Program, a massive array of dipoles up in Alaska. There's one in Norway. There are others in other parts of the world, and I think Russia.
Yeah.
That's one of the functions of HAARP. But I thought it was interesting the way you went through the ownership of HAARP and how it was
sort of
bought and sold. Can you go through a little bit of that?
Absolutely. So ARCO was the original contractor for HAARP, which actually it was its subdivision, APTI. They owned HAARP, I believe, for a year or two, and then it was purchased by E-Systems. And E-Systems was a major supplier to the Department of Defense. They had a lot of dealings with the CIA, a huge military contractor. They only kept it for about a year, and then Raytheon, who has a very close relationship with NOAA, purchased E-Systems, thus acquiring HAARP. Also, Raytheon receives huge, huge contracts to monitor the weather. They also received a huge contract for weather for the terminal weather system. In fact, they're monitoring and feeding us the weather for the next, up until, I believe, 2014. They have a huge multi-billion dollar contract. In 1997, I believe it was, Raytheon and Hughes Aircraft Company merged, which is Howard Hughes Aircraft Company, which may not mean a lot except the fact that it created a multi-billion dollar industry. And that was, Hughes Aircraft actually created the patent, which is a lot of people consider, you know, the smoking gun for the aerosol program. In 1991, the stratospheric well-stack seeding for reduction of global warming. If you're going to piece everything together, now you have Raytheon, which controls the weather and can basically tell us what we're going to have, and you have it in a partnership with NOAA, and you have it with Hughes Aircraft, which is a huge aircraft company. Those are some pieces to the puzzle right there. And then it was interesting because in 2006, BAE, which is British Aerospace Enterprise, which is another huge airline, they make airplanes, they have numerous contracts with our Defense Department for fighter planes. I know that they supplied a lot of fighter planes to our government. They then purchased HAARP, well, or the actual design of HAARP, the contract for making it work, they purchased it from Raytheon. And the interesting thing about BAE is that, and this is where the individuals who are in charge of all these companies have major connections. Sidney Gillibrand was the CEO of BAE for a number of years, and his son also, I believe he was an engineer at the company, he married Senator Gillibrand, who is the current senator of New York State, my senator, or your senator. And I know she was a legislator in upstate New York, and I'm very involved with the Bonfire Coalition. And the person who's in charge of that, Bonnie Hogue, tried numerous times to contact her regarding the aerosol program. I actually was on a conference call to ask some questions about what was taking place in our skies, and she has yet to respond to anything. And once you start finding out who her father-in-law is and the connections, it kind of makes sense why we're not getting any sort of feedback.
And you took it even further here with the 9/11 connection. Can you explain that?
Oh, yeah. He also, Gillibrand, Sidney Gillibrand, upon leaving BAE Systems, he then went to work with at AMEC, AMAC, and his company was responsible for building Wedge 1, which was the area of the Pentagon that was hit in 9/11, supposedly. And following the attack, his company was also one of the main contractors for Iraq and rebuilding the sewer systems and the water drainage pipes and things like that. He's been quite connected, and he gets a lot of work. So that's his connection with 9/11 and with the aerosol program, and like I said, his daughter-in-law is the senator of New York.
That's really amazing work that you've done here to make those connections and to pull this all together. Not many others have not done this, and I'm glad you did this work. We can go back now to ARCO for a minute, and you were talking
sure.
We were talking about Bernard Eastland's patents, and there were three particular ones that you identified. Can you talk about those and how they relate to this bigger picture?
Jeff, you should know that Bernard Eastland was a scientist who worked for ARCO, and he actually lived on Long Island and was considered quite brilliant. And the first patent that he created under ARCO was the method and apparatus for creating an artificial electron cyclotron heating region of plasma, which is exactly where HAARP comes into it. And the second patent he created in 1987 was a method and apparatus for altering a region in the Earth's atmosphere, ionosphere, and magnetosphere. And the third one he made was in 1991, and that was the method for producing a shell of relativistic particles at an altitude above the Earth's surface. And these all were the impetus to the creation of HAARP, to alter the ionosphere.
By altering the ionosphere, we've discussed in other news in the past, some researchers suggest that is one of the key factors to alter the weather, control the weather, etc. And these are all connected with military programs to own the weather by 2025, as the white paper study suggests.
And which also connects the patents for chaff dispersal, because that's why they're doing that.
Chaff is aluminum-coated fiberglass, is it?
Yes, and there's been numerous weathermen actually who've come out and have given weather reports stating that the clouds that they're seeing are actually man-made.
That's true, right. They'll see on their radar image, there's some kind of reflection on the radar, and they know they are not clouds or it's not rain, but somehow they've got the information that there are military exercises in the area, and there's a weatherman in Florida, and you could find those on YouTube. It's really easy to look up. Again, these are more and more examples of this, you know, coming out. But if you see these weather reports on YouTube like this and you don't know the bigger picture, it's not going to really make much sense to you. And that's why I think you really did a fantastic job here trying to pull all of this together. And now we can go to let's go to the Gulf oil disaster. And that was sort of the trigger for you to begin a lot of this research. Can you talk about Nalco, about CoreExit, Goldman Sachs, and
sure.
Put that in perspective for the listeners.
Well, like you said, when I started researching the Gulf disaster, I was absolutely amazed at how BP seemed to be a part of everything. And one of the first things I found out about BP was that in 1968, it merged with Standard Oil of Ohio, which was, once again, one of the Rockefeller, one of the oil companies that emerged from the breakup. And then I found out that BP, in 1998, BP bought Amoco, which was Standard Oil of Indiana, which, of course, was owned by the Rockefellers. And like I said before, they acquired Amoco Chemicals. And BP also is a huge chemical company in its own right. And then once again, BP bought ARCO, and it acquired ARCO Aluminum. And then as I started to investigate further, I found out that BP had numerous dealings and numerous business arrangements with other chemical companies. And while I was also researching this, of course, because once you start, like I said, researching the aerosol program, I started coming into a lot of information about a disease that actually has only come, you know, to be in the last 2 or 3 years called Morgellons. I took a detour and I started looking a lot into that. One of the reasons was because BP in 2000 merged with Pavilion Technologies to create polyethylene manufacturing facilities. And then they, in 2001, BP merged with Eastman Chemical to create a more advanced polyethylene technology. And that is when I really started making a link, like I said, with Morgellons. Because what Morgellons is, it's a disease where individuals start to exhibit open sores throughout their body. And if they feel like as though things are crawling under their skin and they're very itchy and the sores don't heal. And what eventually starts to happen is that these fibers, these hair-like fibers, start to come out of their skin. But they're not hairs. In fact, they've been investigated, and they've been investigated by numerous people. Dr. Hildegard Stanninger has done a lot of research with actually Cliff Carnicom, carnicom.com. And what Dr. Stanninger has found out is that these fibers are self-replicating. They burn at 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit, and they burn a little bit, but they still do not melt. And they continuously replicate. And what they are is they're made of numerous things, but specifically high-density polyethylene fiber. And that was the connection that I made with BP, because BP is continuously merging with people to create these polyethylene facilities throughout, and that's what the outer casing of what's coming out of people's skin is made of. And the CDC started an investigation, because now approximately 1,000 people a day are coming forward and being diagnosed with Morgellons, and they started an investigation into Morgellons in 2008 with the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. And like I said, once you start investigating one area, it leads you right to another. So I started looking up the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and I found out that they have a very interesting history. The Rockefellers in the 1900s through 1940, they were very interested in eugenics, which I'm sure most of your listeners know is, you know, the creation trying to make a perfect race of people. And they started Cold Spring Harbor out here on Long Island, but they also created the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Germany, which is sister, I guess you could say, of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which is investigating Morgellons. But the interesting thing about the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, the lead researcher for them in eugenics was Joseph Mengele, and he was the medical commandant at Auschwitz. And he used to do tests on the prisoners to promote and further the eugenics research. So when I started investigating the CDC about Morgellons and found out that the, you know, Kaiser Institute was involved, I don't really have a lot of faith of them coming out and saying what's actually in these fibers and what's actually occurring, because if the Rockefellers are involved in it and they've been involved in depopulation, they started the Rockefeller Population Council in 1952. They're very involved in anti-fertility, genetically modified organisms. In fact, recently I found out that one of the genetically modified organisms that they have invested a lot of research is the cottonseed, and they have now actually been able to make it where it's not toxic in terms of if you eat it, you know, you'll get very sick, but it still retains its anti-fertility properties, and that's one of the big things, like I said, that the Rockefeller Foundation, they really believe that the population of the planet needs to be decreased.
Well, Cindy, I didn't expect you to go all the way out
there. I didn't
there.
Either.
You also had pointed out that there was an agrobacteria used by Monsanto that is also integral in the Morgellons fibers. There's something in there as well.
Wait a minute. Let's back into this. First, let's say not going to have a measurable effect on the global climate. You're saying putting tens of millions of tons, which is the stated goal of geoengineer David Keith, who I know you know and work with, his stated goal on the record, Doug, your listeners can look this up, Jeff, is to put 20 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates into the atmosphere. You're saying that that wouldn't affect the global climate? We have NOAA stating that the aircraft trails, whatever those are radically affecting the global climate. How can you possibly say it wouldn't affect the climate? Do you want to clarify that question first?
Dane, did you want to repeat back the previous sentence that I made about altitude?
No. You said that if they were putting materials into the climate at 40,000 feet, it would not affect the climate. How can you possibly make that statement? When you alter convection, Doug, I'm losing 60, 70, 80% of my solar PV uptake because of direct sunlight loss. When you cover the horizon and aircraft emissions are covering the entire horizon, how can you possibly say, when NOAA admits on the record, that that has a radical effect on the climate? Your only argument, Doug, is that you're talking about your definition of 70.
That has been made.
Hey, wait a minute.
Hold,
you said
hold,
question I'm interrupting of, you, and you're not letting me finish, Doug.
Hold on.
Let Dane finish.
Go ahead, Dane.
Your argument is what you describe as Douglas McMartin's personal definition of climate engineering occurring at 70,000 feet, and you know that that's not occurring. That's not what we're talking about here, Doug. That's not what we're talking about. Do you know or deny that David Keith has proposed putting tens of millions of tons of aluminum nanoparticulates, the most recognized geoengineer in the world, into the atmosphere? Will you acknowledge that?
I think that is a highly misleading statement on at least three counts.
Do you deny that he said
that? I think you know it's a misleading statement. First of all,
I'm asking, do you know he said that?
I would say that is a highly misleading statement, and I think it would be the correct statement is David Keith wrote a paper that essentially asked the question of, hey, everybody normally talks about putting sulfate. Maybe you could do this with aluminum. And he wrote the paper, and I think the conclusion from that paper was, yeah, you could do it, but it probably wouldn't be a good idea. That's not the same as proposing something. It's basically asking a question and answering it. The amount of material that he was talking about, once again, he was talking about putting that sufficiently high into the atmosphere that you're up in the region where you have a residence time of a year, not in a region where you have a residence time of a week.
So why does MIT then, Doug, state from David Keith that geoengineering would be incredibly cheap and easy? Quote from MIT. You're saying it's impossible. Dr. Keith
today,
at MIT saying it would be incredibly cheap and easy. How do you refute that?
The difference between the English tense would be and the English word is.
You know, semantics aren't going to change this argument. That's exactly what was stated.
Dane, that's not semantics.
Future tense.
Tense actually
not
matters.
Future tense.
The difference between something
be
being possible and something being done. I think you should understand that. And don't try to insult people.
So your interpretation
with
of
the distinction between
David
saying
Keith
something would be easy is proof that it is currently easy today. Those are not the same thing.
So wood means in their term, what, 100 years from now or 200 years from now? Because none of their data states that. It says right now. And Doug, I was at the conference where David Keith proposed 10 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates in the atmosphere. So it's on film. I would ask your listeners to look at that. You know, you from every angle, when the stratosphere definition is redefined by you, when the NOAA study is redefined by you, not citing any particular source, and now you redefine the MIT study, which directly from David Keith and MIT stating it would be cheap and easy, not off in the future, now. So you're adding your own interpretation onto everything and asking us to accept that as fact. I'm sorry, I'm not going to throw all these facts out the window because you say differently.
Actually, I think you're just not listening to what I'm saying.
I am listening
I think
to what you're saying.
That it would not fundamentally be difficult to design an airplane that could do that. That's not the same statement as an aircraft currently exists to do that. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. The studies don't
agree
say
with
anything,
the
that anything of that type.
Is
that's,
different
you know, you're making
existing?
This up as you go, my friend. The studies don't say anything like that. Nothing like that.
Professor McMartin, this is a radio station. You can't use profanity. Okay, so please
it's
don't
just,
do that again.
Dane is refusing to answer a simple question. Dane, do you believe that there is a distinction between saying something is possible and something is being done? Yes or no?
It's an irrelevant question, Doug.
It's not an
irrelevant
question because
be.
You're claiming that I'm saying those are... that is the part of the basis of your argument.
Can we jump...
You said
can
I'm
we get
redefining
past this?
What MIT said, and I'm saying no, you're the one redefining it. Answer the question, yes or no?
Doug, the study doesn't say what you said, period.
It says it would be easy. I agree.
It doesn't say someday we could design aircraft. It says that this is the capability now.
This is a second debate with Professor Beckwith. As you'll hear in this 1 hour, the discussion breaks down as Beckwith refuses to directly respond to specific questions. Yet it was a very important discussion to get on record during a live radio broadcast. Let's have a listen. And in this second hour, we welcome back Professor Paul Beckwith for round two. Professor Beckwith is a physicist and engineer. He's a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and is in a PhD program with a focus on abrupt climate system change. And he's also with Carleton University Department of Geography and Environmental Studies. Mr. Beckwith does not believe global climate engineering operations have been deployed, but has agreed to look into Dane's research since the last debate. And again, we're here with Dane Wigington, the lead researcher for geoengineeringwatch.org, who focuses on the climate engineering issue and claims available evidence indicates geoengineering has been fully deployed for decades with catastrophic effects. Paul, welcome back to the live geoengineering discussion.
Hello.
Now, Professor Beckwith, could you please refresh listeners with a brief explanation of the type of research you're doing?
I look at the overall climate system and how the pieces fit together and how where basically the climate was in the past, where it is now, and where it's heading in the future. So I look at abrupt climate change, how it causes great changes in the Arctic and how those changes in the Arctic disrupt the jet stream, causing extreme weather events around the world that we're seeing.
I asked if you would look at some of Dane's research on climate engineering. What did you find out?
Well, we just we have a fundamental difference in the causes for what is causing climate disruption or climate mayhem. We more or less agree that something's going on, that we're getting significant changes that are not good to, we're getting cities flooded out. We're getting rapid sea level rise. We're getting, massive hurricanes hitting the U.S., for example, because the ocean waters are much warmer. We're getting disruption of ocean currents. So we're getting all of these things happening, but our fundamental reasoning for why it's happening seems to be very, very different. And I guess the way to deal with it is also different, because Dane would argue that we just need to stop doing all of these things humans are doing to presently disrupt the climate, and I argue that we need to deal with our greenhouse gases, that we need to actually work on ways to restore the climate that we had growing up as children so that our grandchildren have a similar stable climate. So we're different in, so there is agreement in some areas. I don't know, maybe Dane can comment.
Sure. I just wanted to clarify that researching some of Dane's material on climate engineering, were you able to agree on that climate engineering is actually occurring in real time that is causing some of the climate change that you're studying?
No, I don't believe that climate engineering is occurring at the moment to cause this disruption of our weather systems. I believe this disruption of our weather systems is happening based on the changes in the way that heat is distributed around the planet and the way that we've heated the Arctic much, much faster than the rest of any other part of the planet. And that's thrown off the way that heat is transferred from the equator to the Arctic in the ocean current and in the jet stream. And those disruptions are a direct result of the Arctic temperature amplification, warming. And I also believe that in order to deal with this problem, we need to look at ways to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We need to look at ways to cool the Arctic, to stabilize the climate, as well as, you know, what everybody says, slash fossil fuel emissions. So I don't believe that we're engineering the climate.
Oh, okay.
Fundamental.
So it seems like I gotcha. We're back at, yeah. I think we're back at square one from the first hour. Dane, what are your responses here?
Well, first of all, thanks for joining us again in this continued debate. I think it's very necessary and essential. You stated we have a different opinion as to the causes of the abrupt climate collapse, which I think we both agree is occurring. I would like to state for the record that it's not a this or that, and I think if you still think or believe that I am blaming everything on climate engineering, that's absolutely not the case. I lectured on climate change before I focused my energies on climate engineering because I believed it to be the superseding issue. Without addressing this issue, there can be no legitimate discussion of the state of the climate. So I would argue it's definitely not a this or that. And I think, Paul, you would agree, I believe, that any form of human activity that alters the energy balance of the climate or the natural processes of the planet would be a form of geoengineering, would it not?
Well, I think the definition of geoengineering talks about intentional large-scale modification of the climate. Of course, every human activity, you know, in the history of humanity has an impact on the climate. And it just there's enough of us now, 7.6, 7.7 billion, and our technology is so advanced and large, you know, huge machines that can scrape the top of the earth off and get to the tar sands underneath. Our technologies are so vast and there's so many of us where our impacts on the planet are greater and greater and greater. But the definition of geoengineering is intentional large-scale modification of the climate. And I don't, you know, this is unintentional. This is unintentional as a result of the fossil fuel industry.
But is it not, if I could be, just so I don't lose my point, I'm sorry, because I didn't want to go off in a different direction here, right? And don't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to lose my point. I have heard you say in a dissemination that in any form of human activity that alters the energy balance of the planet is a form of geoengineering. I think logically, rationally, that's correct. I mean, whether it's intentional or non-intentional is not necessarily the point. It's still, by definition, any form of human activity that alters the energy balance of the planet, I believe, must be considered a form of geoengineering because it's altering the natural systems. Now, this being said, if jet aircraft emissions can cover the entire sky, blotting out the sun, blocking solar energy from solar panels, which I know firsthand, I can state this for certain again, as my background is in solar energy. My off-grid home was the cover article for the world's largest renewable energy magazine. We know that commercial solar power facilities are not generating anywhere near the amount of power they were expected to generate. The scientifically term scenario of global dimming is undeniable. The part jet aircraft emissions are playing in this global dimming scenario is undeniable. The goal of solar radiation management proposals is to create a global dimming scenario with jet aircraft sprayed particulates. The exact elements named in solar radiation management patents are showing up in every single lab test of precipitation we take. I would just ask, Paul, what am I missing? Why should we accept the official denial of ongoing solar radiation management, and whatever one wants to consider the composition of what's coming out of these aircraft, why would we not consider that to be a form of geoengineering, whether intentional or otherwise?
Well, we could try to define geoengineering different ways, but if you go to the Oxford Dictionary or look at the Webster Dictionary on the definition, there is that intended component, and there's also the global large-scale component. I mean, otherwise you could argue that creating snow on a ski hill is a form of geoengineering. In terms of the aerosols, yes, we know about global dimming. The coal burning, coal contains sulfur, and there's vast amounts of burning of coal in power plants in China and India, and, you know, more so in third world countries. Well, not in the West, per se, so much now. I mean, we based the Industrial Revolution on coal, but we've reduced it. We've gone to natural gas, which is a bit cleaner burning. But it does put aerosols up in the atmosphere, the particulates. And these particulates do cause a cooling. They shield some of the sunlight. Again, this is not intended. This is a byproduct of industrial civilization, these aerosols, right? So it has an effect on the climate, but it doesn't really fit under the strict definition of geoengineering. It's not intended to cool the planet. They're not pumping up. We don't have coal plants trying to cool the planet, right? We have coal plants to produce electrical energy.
I'm referring to specifically, though, Paul, what's being emitted from jet aircraft, not from coal power plants. We have no such plants on the Pacific Northwest where I exist. It's the Pacific Ocean for many thousands of miles. We know, in the case, for example, of aluminum, that aerosol is not migrating from China. We have California Air Resource Board studies to prove that. We have massive amounts of aluminum coming down in our precipitation here. It's a primary element named in climate engineering patents. It's of recent origin. We know that from soil's pH changes, so it's a recent phenomenon. It matches, and again, back to the point I was trying to make, I'm speaking specifically about jet aircraft emissions. Whatever one wants to consider the composition of those emissions is not necessarily relevant for this conversation, but jet aircraft emissions that expand and linger in the sky, covering the entire sky, sometimes blocking 60-80% of my solar uptake, how can that not be considered a form of geoengineering? And if that's not solar radiation management, even though it's exactly what is described by solar radiation management proposals, jet aircraft spraying particulates into the sky, if that's not what's happening, what is it? And how can we not consider that to be an effect on the climate when, again, jet aircraft emissions, whatever you want to consider them, are literally blotting out the entire sky on many days? How can that not be considered a form of geoengineering?
You're arguing that jet aircraft exhaust is intentionally...
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying whatever you want to consider the composition or the agenda or lack of agenda, the fact that it's happening, it is happening. I mean, we're talking about days that literally block 60 to 80% of my solar PV uptake sometimes. So how can that not...
60 to 80%, you know, maybe you could provide some evidence. Those numbers seem very, very high, 60 to 80%. I could see a few percent, but, you know, 60 or 80%, I mean, it's almost dark. You're saying
there are days, Paul, when aircraft emissions.
If 100% is blocked, we've got it completely dark during the middle of the day, right? 80%.
No, that's not true. Paul, that's not at all true. On a cloudy day, on a naturally cloudy day with a heavy storm, the solar PV uptake. You may not or must not be familiar in this arena. Solar PV uptake on a day where there is clearly enough visible light when a storm is passing over, I may have a 95% reduction in solar PV uptake. So PV is sensitive.
Yes,
it's not
because it's directly over your particular panels. But, I mean, the sky is large. You're saying the entire sky is covered. If the entire sky is covered with, you know, 95% blockage, it's basically dark. I mean,
you need
100%
to...
blockage. But anyway, the point is...
But Paul,
on
that point, let me finish on that point, though. I'll let you go on.
Okay.
You need to perhaps research solar voltaic characteristics because it's light outside.
I do know about, I mean, there's the diffuse light, there's the direct light. You know, what you're talking about is the direct light is blocked, but there's still diffuse light that's coming.
Nothing to do with being dark.
Dane, let me jump in for a second.
Sure.
Could you describe what you were describing to me when you were driving down the road last week, and you could see this overcast cover and also the trails on the edges of this overcast cover? Could you describe that for listeners and Professor Beckwith?
Well, I think time-lapse film footage, which we have at geoengineeringwatch.org, Paul, would be helpful to you and to listeners to look and see firsthand on a time-lapse video that the aircraft dispersions, emissions, whatever you want to call them, whatever you want to conclude that the composition of those emissions are, that they, in fact, frequently cover the entire sky, the entire horizon. And my point is this, again, even if we want to accept the official narrative that that's condensation, which I would argue, and I will add more data to that in a moment, the science does not support that that is condensation for many reasons, including the fact that all commercial carriers and all military tankers have a high bypass turbofan jet engine. Only 15% of the air that passes through that engine is combusted, so they're nearly incapable of producing any condensation trail except under rare and extreme circumstances. But even if we pretend, or we assume, or we accept the official narrative that that's just condensation, how can that not be considered geoengineering when it can literally cover the entire horizon? And on some days, yes, block 60 to 80% of my solar PV uptake. And we have commercial plants with the same type of statistics. They're producing just over half what they were designed to produce. There's clearly something radical going on. We can see that these emissions from time-lapse photography are the sole source of the canopy that's covering horizon to horizon on many days. Paul, I'm just asking a question. How can we not consider that to be geoengineering, whether intentional or otherwise?
Well, I guess I'm questioning the... let me ask you a question. Does the temperature plummet when this happens in your region? It's still warm days.
Certainly, when it blocks the direct sunlight and the heat of the day, there is typically a temperature reduction. However, that blanket, that canopy, as NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has also acknowledged, is trapping heat. And thus, nighttime temperatures are not just because of the aircraft emissions. Obviously, we have methane, nitrous oxide, CO2, all building up in the atmosphere, all causing nighttime temperatures to escalate twice as fast as daytime highs. But,
so what's the source of the heat? What's the source of the heat in your region where 60 to 80% of the light is blocked? Because it should be a lot colder than it is if it's 60 to 80%. And then, it's going to be very cold during the day, and there won't be that much heat to be blocked. It depends on altitude of clouds or aerosols as to whether heat is blocked or not. It's generally the cirrus clouds that... keep heat trapped in, and it's the low altitude clouds that make it cooler under at the ground. They block incoming sunlight. So and that depends on the nature of the particles, like the aerosols, the nature of the size, for example. The reason why the sky is blue is because of the size of the nitrogen molecules in the air. They scatter light. They scatter blue light a lot more. They scatter the long wavelengths and they reflect those away. What you're left is with blue. So your eye gets the blue. There's a lot more blue light scattered to your eye when you look up. So the sky appears blue. So it depends on the particle size. If you've got rain clouds, for example, very black clouds, those are very large droplets. Almost no light is coming back to your eye from those. So, we can talk about atmospheric physics, I guess I just see, it doesn't make sense to me. It's obvious if people are trying to geoengineer to cool the planet because of climate change, it's certainly not working. I mean, temperatures are still skyrocketing. Our climate disasters are getting a lot worse. If we wanted, there are, I can tell you of some definite things that are going on in attempts to look at, study, solar radiation management or geoengineering. I mean, one idea that was just in the press a few days ago was little silica particles to put on the ice. It's basically sand, very highly reflective, but it's very reflective white sand, so about the size of a human hair. So if you put that on the sea ice, and they're testing this in Alaska on the lake, they're trying to see whether it can preserve ice on the lake, whether it'll last, stick around for a while. David Keith is looking at spraying water or sulfur from a balloon in the atmosphere to do that. People are looking at ways to put solar panels, solar pumps on the sea ice to pump water from below the ice onto the surface of the ice where it can freeze if the air is still below zero, because ice is a very good insulator. So people are starting to do some of these, and you can sort of track the funding. I mean, what you're talking about...
I think
about,
we're diverging, though, Paul. Forgive me. I don't want to diverge from the subject at hand of all the various proposals, which I would argue are simply red herrings to take people's eye off the fact or to confuse them as to the fact that climate engineering is ongoing. And what I'm trying to ask you, if you'll let me, on the blue skies part, we don't see many here in Northern California. Perhaps you see some in Canada, although we hear from many people in Canada that don't see them now as well either. And climate engineering, specifically stated by science institutions around the globe, will completely alter our once blue skies. That's in fact what we see. But my question to you again is, very simply, if you could ask, if we know, we have film footage to prove over and over and over that aircraft emissions, whatever we want to consider the composition of those emissions, can and are blotting out the entire sky frequently, constantly, consistently, how can we not consider that a form of geoengineering? How can that not be considered in the equation? And if that's not geoengineering, if you're saying that that's not actually geoengineering, how do you know that? And if that's not geoengineering, what exactly would stratospheric aerosol geoengineering look like when it's proposed to be sprayed particulates from jets? If it doesn't look like that, what would it look like?
Okay, well,
Paul, let me jump in for a second. Can you answer? Hold on. I know he asked a lot of questions, but could you answer this question in particular? How do you know for sure that geoengineering isn't occurring in the way that Dane described? Like, what data do you have that convinces you?
Well, you know, science. So first of all, there's a number. I would argue, there's no way you're blocking 80% of the sunlight.
I didn't say sunlight. Paul, I said 80% of solar power uptake.
I just don't believe those numbers. Air traffic control is way, way up. You can get a flight. You can go on websites and get a flight to Europe for a few hundred bucks.
That's actually not true. It's actually not true. It's decreased.
Okay. Number of aircraft flying is way, way up. It's exploding in numbers. Airports are still being built around the world. There's way more air traffic than there used to be. That's one thing. The second thing is the stratosphere has cooled. Okay? Part of climate change is that the greenhouse gases trap the heat in the lower atmosphere, the troposphere. Less light gets back up into the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere. So the stratosphere cools. That's the second key point. The third key point is there's always water vapor in combustion from jet engines, and that water vapor in a cooler environment is going to condense, and those condensation trails stick around for a long period of time depending on the conditions. But the conditions are favorable for them to stick around for a long period of time. So those are things that I know. Like what Dane is talking about would be trillions and trillions of dollars of money that isn't being accounted for anywhere.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.